Right, so as part of this roadmap law, what it called out was for changes to existing policies. One of the most familiar existing policies is something called Mass Save. And if you drive up Route 93, you'll oftentimes see a big sign on Route 93 saying, sign up for Mass Save.
This is Steve Sherlockman of the Franklin Matters Radio Show, number 738 in the series. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Ted McIntyre, Franklin resident and climate activist. We recorded this via the Zoom Conference Bridge on February 17, 2022. This is part three of a series that we're doing together on making sense of climate. In this session, we point you to a couple of recent Climate Minute podcasts for related info. We then cover three recent news articles and discuss how they can affect the mass roadmap to a net zero 2050. If you have climate questions or Franklin-specific climate questions, send them in and we'll try to answer them in a future session. The recording runs about 38 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Ted McIntyre.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the Franklin Mass FM dial at 102.9, here for another Making Sense of Climate session with our resident expert, Ted McIntyre. Happy Thursday, Ted.
Happy Thursday to you, Steve. Great to be here.
It's good having you so we can help me understand a little bit more about this. It's just... and setting the stage for the people who haven't, we've done two others. This is the third. And the first two, we spent a good deal of time around, well, I think it was 12 initially, we determined it was really 13 in a list that effectively summarized the legislation that Mass passed and is the plan to get us to a carbon neutral future in what, 2050?
Which isn't so far away when you start thinking about it, but yeah, 2050 is the ultimate target of the roadmap legislation, which was passed just about this time last year, and it puts into law a bunch of good policies for addressing climate change. And in particular, there's an interim goal in the year 2030 where we should have significantly reduced our carbon dioxide emissions, because that's a greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. And the important thing from my perspective is that we look to the roadmap as a guide, and that we understand that this is kind of a journey. There's going to be setbacks, successes, detours, things we learn. And in fact, the roadmap legislation, it's called the Next Generation Roadmap for Climate Change, needs additional implementation of policies and probably more laws and all mm-hmm. kinds of stuff. But the roadmap is a framework in which you can begin to understand the blizzard of news that you see crossing your, I guess we call it a timeline nowadays for mm-hmm. people on Twitter, but whether you're watching cable or reading the globe. So yes, you're right to talk about this roadmap as a convenient context for understanding things.
And I think if we keep that as our framework, there are, to your point, timeline pieces. How are we doing? It's kind of like, you know, going to the doctor's office every once in a while. What's the temperature? How's your weight? Are you up or down? What else do you need to do? What do you need to address? But to your point is,
as you may remember, there is a target. So there's an explicit target in the bill that calls for a 50% reduction of greenhouse gases by 2030 mm-hmm. from the whole state. But the people who made the roadmap, the legislators, were smart enough to say that additionally, in addition to this economy-wide 50%, there would be subsectors. And each of those subsectors had to achieve the goal as well. So you have subsectors about transportation, about residential housing, mm-hmm. about how we generate electricity. So that's a really good way to further parse the issue. Because if you say, oh, we're going to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, like, what does that mean? Mm. Right? But you say, okay, no, we're going to cut our emissions from transportation by 50%, right? All of a sudden, now you start thinking, you know, electric buses, electric vehicles, better mm-hmm. planning, reducing miles traveled, yada, yada, yada. So there's a lot there to help.
Yeah. So for framing again for our listeners, thank you for listening. We're not necessarily going to boil the ocean, maybe a good pun or analogy in this case, but we're certainly going to tackle at least a couple of pieces along this roadmap, along these targets, along these topics to help me make some sense and hopefully help you make some sense of what's happening along the way. And I know there's a couple of topics that we started discussing beforehand, and effectively you've already covered these in another podcast. So let's give that a link so that people can go there if they want to listen to those details.
Right. So as part of this roadmap law, what it called out was for changes to existing policies. One of the most familiar existing policies is something called Mass Save. And if you drive up Route 93, you'll oftentimes see a big sign on Route 93 saying, sign up for Mass Save. Mass Save is funded by a small payment on everyone's electric bill. Everyone's paying into it, right? So there's a fund there. If what you can do is to call up Mass Save and they will send someone to your house or even do it virtually, right? But anyway, someone will come look at your house and say, oh yeah, you could benefit from some insulation here and there. You probably need better windows. Look, your furnace is getting old, et cetera, et cetera. Start thinking about these things. And it helps you reduce your carbon emissions by making your home more affordable. The state has essentially doubled that program and is now, in fact, adding, you know, help if you want to put in a heat pump, which again is a whole other universe of information to talk about, right? But these are ways that you can essentially get your house, fully electrify your house. Mass Save is trying to help do that. The other interesting sort of this implementation of the roadmap is that the state, after about a year's delay, doubled the size of the solar program to help people put solar panels on their roof in businesses and whatnot. That got caught up in a bureaucratic delay, right, at the DPU, which of course then brings into question, like, how come it was so slow to make this very easy change, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what we did in the Climate Minute, which we can put a link to, right, is a separate podcast that I produce, and we talked about what's in those two programs. And in fact, this is now this coming Sunday on the 20th of February, we will be posting a show, or soon after that, posting a show with an actual young man who does those home inspections, and will lead people through. What do they do when they show up? What are they looking at? Why does it matter to you? And in fact, when you do that Mass Save thing, all of a sudden it frees up the rebates, right? So now once you've had the inspection, you can say, oh, I want to put in a heat pump or improve my air conditioner. You might get some money back from the state. So it's all good.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are things that people can go listen to. They're related here because they're part of the implementation of the roadmap, which is trying to get us all to 2030.
Yeah. So just having said that, there's a couple of pieces you can go deep dive, get into the Climate Minute, listen to that piece, and we'll focus on a couple of pieces here. And then our series will continue. We'll pick a couple more along the way as we work down this roadmap, down this timeline, and follow what work is being done. And, how do we take advantage of it? You know, kind of bring it back to the residential level where we can. Because I know as we talked, I think in one of the first two sessions, at least, the geothermal piece certainly sounds like my next move. I had already upgraded and I've seen benefits to the existing oil furnace, but that was done a few years ago. At some point in time, we need to get off oil. We need to get off natural gas, et cetera. So
the terminology, fascinating terminology, the other terminology that people talk about nowadays is heat pumps. Mm-hmm. Right. And you can basically what a heat pump is a refrigerator like you have in your kitchen. I often joke that you've got a heat pump in your house. It's called a refrigerator. Right. Mm-hmm. What you can do is basically pump heat from the outside of the house, from the air into your home. Right. So that's a very efficient way of doing it. And then there's additionally the geothermal means you drill a well and you have this reference temperature in the earth. great stuff. Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's the future direction of home heating in Massachusetts.
So. Yeah. And as we find out more about that, and I think we teased, there's a pilot program in Framingham for a kind of a micro district for that geothermal implementation as they clearly go through their pilot and get some results and raise some issues potentially. I'm sure they'll have to resolve. We'll find that and bring that back here too.
We should, yes. And we can, we can include the links, but there was an article in the Globe just this past Sunday, I think, by the people at HEAT, H-E-E-T, which is the Home Energy Efficiency Team, the two founders, they are the ones that had this genius idea about sharing the geothermal well among a bunch of houses, right? And they have a great write-up in the Globe. It would be fascinating to maybe I can dig into that. We can talk about it a little bit more at some future point. But it's a quite, again, this is all related, comes back to the roadmap of how are we going to convert all of our homes, the million homes in Massachusetts, over to being electrified.
Right. Yeah. And I think to tie it into and give us a segue or a slide or a water path, there was another Globe article this week that caught both our attention around the sea levels rising in Boston in particular. And I know having worked in Boston even a few years ago, that I couldn't walk along the federal courthouse waterfront because the tide at that time was already ankle deep and I couldn't enjoy my lunch walk on certain days. And it's exponentially more so now and projected to be even worse as it comes.
It is. It's a remarkable thing. And it's very, well, not confusing to talk about, but you have to choose your words carefully, right? So sea level rise is this phenomenon that's been going on. And it's connected to a lot. I mean, there are many, many things, but fundamentally the idea is we're melting ice into the ocean, right? Two things. You're melting ice water into the ocean, which is why if Greenland or Antarctica were to melt, we'd have a serious issue. Put that aside. The other thing is that everything expands when it gets warmer. Mm-hmm. So as the ocean gets warmer, even if it only goes up a tiny few degrees, it's an enormous thing. And so it expands, right? And the question of sea level rise, I mean, we already see it in some sense in Boston. I mean, everyone has got, at least I have, but it's not so hard to find pictures of the storm in 2018 where the aquarium tea stop downtown was flooded, right? It just, foot of water all around that. And as the sea levels inexorably rise from melting and what's called subsidence as the land sinks and the sea levels rise, the ocean, all that stuff. What happens is that the high tide, first of all, the high tides get higher. So you hear about what are called king tides, and you just made reference to probably a high tide situation where the water is up on the shore, right? Mm-hmm. That is and of course, down in Florida, you hear this already because underneath Miami, I guess it's very porous rock. So as these big tides come in, the water comes up out of the sewer. It's sunny day flooding, right? Yeah. That's the first hint. The other hint is that when you do have a storm, right, you have what's called the doming effect. So when I was a kid, maybe you did this. When I was a kid washing the dishes under my mother's tutelage, I would be standing there washing things. You take a glass, right, in the bucket of water. You turn the glass upside down, full of water. Then you try and lift the glass out of the water and see how much water you could keep in the glass, right, with keeping the rim underwater. And it was a fun game when you were eight, right?
Well, it gave you an excuse not to wash the dishes because you were doing something at least, just slowly and having some fun while you were doing it.
The same thing is true. So essentially when you do that is the water pressure, the air pressure pushing the water down inside the glass is non-existent. So all of the air pressure around the water is what's pushing the water up into the glass. Same thing holds true with storms. If you have a hurricane, the pressure in the middle is lower, so the ocean level rises, and that's the big... If we were to have a storm, a bad storm at a high tide,
and the storm
when the
surges.
Sea level has raised, that whole dome of water is going to go farther inland, right? Mm-hmm. So again, these are the precursor effects of the sea level rise. And what they're talking about is something like, in the best case, 1 foot of sea level rise. In the worst case, 6 feet. And so again, I'm all about the images here. imagine you go to your favorite beach, right? You walk up to the high tide mark, or you look where's the rack on the rock. You know how the rocks are discolored?
Sure.
That's the high tide mark, okay?
Yep.
You go to that and say, okay, you stand there. I'm 6 feet tall. I stand there and say, okay, now the water is over my head, right? And goes farther up the beach inland, right? It's not, and that's the flooding. It's not like 6 feet higher, a 6 feet higher high tide mark. Right, is that the water is 6 feet straight up at the high tide mark in the worst case. And that easily, you can easily begin to see where that would wreak real damage in downtown Boston, right? If you go to the Moakley building and stand there and say, okay, now the water is going to be 6 feet higher from where I'm standing, that's going to put it up around around Fenway Park,
right? It may not get to Bunker Hill, but Fenway might be in that area. Who knows? Because Back Bay was the Fenway, was all Fens at some point in early time anyway.
And I mean, that's a whole other.
That's a whole other story.
The whole other story, which is, but you're absolutely right to point out that the Back Bay, the beautiful Back Bay, Storrow Drive, all that kind of stuff, the Esplanade, that's all was filled in the 1870s, right? Yeah. And that's at sea level. So you're going to very quickly flood out the Back Bay, and there's another place you may have heard of called the Seaport, where we have in the last decade sunk billions of dollars into shiny, beautiful buildings that are right at sea level. It's amazing.
And, yes.
Okay. Have you ever been to the Seaport?
Well, I used to work in and around the Seaport, having been a Fidelity employee. Fidelity had a number of buildings along the Seaport right there. The other piece, too, for people who at least have traveled, the airport. Isn't that right across the way?
Yeah. I mean,
by the way, that's flat. It would be hard to land a plane unless we developed seaplane technology for 300, 400 passenger planes.
Yeah. I mean, and the article is very matter of fact saying, you know, this is happening, right? And there's a range, right? So what I found in the article about the sea level rise is that there was a graph showing the amount of how many feet of sea level rise against years. So it goes from 2022 out to the year, let's say 2099, to keep it all in this century, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at that, how much sea level rise, the predictions are almost no matter what we do now, we are committed to a sea level rise until the year 2040, right? It's already baked in. We can't do anything about it. We already emitted the carbon dioxide in 1990 when I drove to work, right? Yep. All done, all gone, right? You begin to see the effect of cutting carbon dioxide emissions only after the year 2040. And when you look at this chart, all of a sudden after the year 2040, you get this splintering of different sea level rise projections based on how much carbon dioxide emission we put out. Mm-hmm. And you say, if we don't do anything, it's going to be 6 feet in the year. It's one of the important lessons that it takes a few decades for the carbon dioxide you emit today to have an impact on the environment. And that's what's so scary.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And that's where I think why we're trying to make sense of climate to this extent. Clearly the culture is, you know, instant satisfaction. And here, even if we do something today, we got to wait 10, 20, 30 years in order to see the effects of it. That's where it's like, how do we do that? No, somebody else will do that. That can't be.
I think since we've touched this point, I just would want to, sometimes the climate movement sets deadlines that it's going to fail, right? And right now we talk about 2030 as this big deadline. And if we don't act by 2030, we're all screwed, okay? That does not mean that on January 1st, 2031, the world is a hellscape, right? It's going to be pretty much the way, you know, it's going to be warmer. There'll be things that be progressive. Problem is that by 2030, you've committed to a level of warming that you can no longer change. And that warming will express itself by 2050, right? So it's your kids are going to live with it. And that's why we say, oh, you know, everything's going to be bad in 2030. No, it's not. It's just going to be just like 2029, pretty much, except that you have now committed your grandchildren to a certain level of carbon dioxide. And this is where to talk about 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees of warming, all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're committing to that. You can't take it back.
Right.
And that's why the 2030 date is so important.
Yep. And indeed, and that's where it's going to be critical for all of us, which is why we're doing this, to keep an eye on the emissions and keep an eye on the roadmap. And one of the other articles in the Globe said, oh, the 2020 report just came out and we probably did okay. But I think the real question in the report, actually, to their credit, was raised that maybe the pandemic did some of that too, and we didn't actually.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in 2008, okay, the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed. Again, it was a groundbreaking thing in 2008. That's a long time ago, right? Massachusetts was a leader in the country. And we committed to, under the roadmap, through the various machinations, we committed to a 25% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2020. 25% by 2020. And that was considered really aggressive, okay? This is 2008 or nine, we made these commitments.
So 12 years prior, yeah.
12 years prior. So now we're into 2022. We're looking back and say, did we make that 2020 number? And you're quite right. It's like we came close. And I think what the article I saw said that we were trying to get a 25% reduction by 2020. In 2019, we had a 22.6% reduction. Right. Not quite there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then along comes the pandemic and everyone starts making sourdough bread and whatnot. Right. Everyone stays home. Carbon dioxide, the emissions plummeted for a little while. So all of a sudden 2020 looks pretty good. But you know, is it real? Can we,
Is it sustainable to pick up that term? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because let's remember, the pandemic has lasted 2+ years at this point. And in those early days, there was a lot of shutdown. So if you were on the road, you were probably the only one of a few on the road at the time. And that had a significant impact, which the numbers are showing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as the pandemic has kind of moved along and we've started the reopening process, which on the one hand, yes, health is important, but we also need to live. We need to work in order to live. That's also important too. But yeah, the climate stuff is, you know, making how we do it efficient climate-wise. So
I think we need to take lessons though from the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think one lesson everyone has taken is that you can do a lot of work from home, right? At least many sure. people, for not sure. all people, yeah, but not many all, people
but a lot of folks, yes.
A lot of people can, right? Yep. And that's something that needs to be built in, mm-hmm. right? We need to use that going forward. This is something that makes my heart sing, but probably would freak other people out. Say, this is a serious proposal that says, look, if you had a 4-day work week, you would cut your carbon dioxide emissions from transit by 20%,
mm-hmm.
like that, right? So have a 4-day work week, yeah. right? And people, I mean, the American culture is so committed to work as the, you know, the Protestant worth ethic. And mm-hmm. we do it, you know, we would never, life goes on with a 4-day work week. And so there are some simple things that could be done to address these issues and take some lessons learned from the pandemic. But you're right. I think that everything's springing back, right? Air travel's back up. You see all the stuff about people punching out the flight attendants.
Well, and I think even to the change as a piece, because obviously we're talking about climate change and what we need to do in order to make it happen. But even in the work environment, it was only, quote, recently that we actually had a 40-hour work week for most folks. You know, and on the government side, it's 37.5, or in some cases, it's corporate is 37.5, but there are organizations that have implemented a 4-day, 10-hour day, et cetera, as a way of cost cutting from a, you know, personnel and staffing, et cetera. But that also did not consider the climate impacts of the transportation, et cetera. So they're actually probably saving more. And thereby, if we use those arguments and extended it again, not everybody can. There's still some service providers, the electricians, the truck drivers, you know, the cooks, essential, et cetera. People. They're still going to need to do stuff and be there. But for the other office workers, even if they're support folks, as long as we get good power, good phone, good connection, we can be anywhere. and do what we need to do.
And I guess I would push it even further, saying there's nothing magic about a 40-hour work week, right? No. We have these blinders on that say, you know, and it's all in pursuit of profit. I keep coming back to the Ursula Le Guin quote. She was the famous science fiction author, right? And at some one of her stories, she or somewhere was said, you know, if you went to a medieval serf in the year 1000 and described individualism and capitalism, they would have no idea what you were talking about, absolutely, right? To the serf in the year, you know, 1092, right? We are living in this thing, capitalism, which is culturally defined. We all think we have to go 40 hours, that God said we all have to work 40 hours a week. We don't, right? No. The sun will come up if we don't make quite as much money, right? If we're a little bit more, so, and then I get into my, you know, there's implications of climate change that go way beyond this roadmap. I mean, it almost drives you to question whether or not the sort of mental stance we take towards the universe, how we live our lives, right, what we value, are they the most important things? And that maybe we have a whole show on that, because that's a big
we can. I think that's related to what we're at least hearing some headlines on in terms of the Great Resignation. People are looking at, oh, what do I really want to do? What is meaningful for me? If I can make the same or similar amount of money doing this as opposed to going to the office and yell at, why not? Right?
Well, that, I mean, it's even in the most macro trend, right? All of science and engineering is working on saving labor, right? We want our artificial intelligence to do things so that we don't have to pay humans to do it, right? But at the same time, we punish people for not having a job. So all of our magic is aimed at getting rid of jobs, right? But at the same time, say, oh, if you don't have a job, you're not a worthwhile human. Somehow that has to be resolved. Yes. Right? I'm not sure how it's going to be resolved, but there's a dichotomy there that you have to accept.
Yeah. We can go off on that end as well. But I'll bring us back a little bit, because there was also, in terms of the roadmap and decisions and work that needs to be done, there was an isoelectric group that made a decision that may jeopardize some of the things that are on the roadmap.
Oh my goodness. This is. So put on your seatbelt, because there's a lot of jargon, a lot of head snapping jargon.
We'll add some terms to our index.
Please make reference to the. So let me just give you some of the major players. There's an organization, a federal organization called the Federal Energy Resources Commission. That acronym is FERC, and they go by the name of FERC, right?
Okay.
FERC. The federal government, basically, they have oversight of all kinds of energy projects and electrical grid issues. I mean, they do they have a lot of authority.
Well, and that to pick up on Jeff Roy's point, that's one of the key pieces of government, is to facilitate some of these large things, not necessarily do it, but to facilitate, provide the convention, provide the coordination, and make sure it happens. So,
exactly. And one, in order to do that, one of the things that FERC did was to divide the country up into regions and establish another layer of bureaucracy just below FERC called the Independent System Operator, or ISO.
Okay.
So all New England is ISO New England, right? ISO New England is who takes care of the grid and makes the grid work. The grid being how you get your electricity. The electricity is powering my laptop, right? The lights in the room, everything comes out of that grid.
So the multiple individual companies, whether National Grid, the town or community government organizations, the MPSs, I think you had the term, municipal service providers.
MLPs, yeah.
MLPs, yeah, right.
But so you got FERC. FERC turns over responsibility to ISO. ISO New England is saying, I'm worried about the long-term reliability of the grid. In fact, ISO is mandated to guarantee the reliability of the grid, right? Note, they are not mandated to reduce carbon dioxide pollution. They are mandated to reduce the reliability of the grid. So, okay, misaligned priorities, yada, yada. Slight, what ISO does is to say, one of the things they do is say, I'm going to worry about who's making the electricity in the year 2025 and 2026, right? And because the electricity cannot currently be stored, it has to be generated in the moment it's used, they talk about the capacity to make electricity, right? Mm-hmm. Who's, and you get paid to have the capacity, the ability to make electricity. And so what they do is they, ISO says, I'm going to have an auction for what's called the forward capacity market. And I'm going to take bids from people who say, yes, I will have a power plant online in the year 2025, and I will sell you my electricity at X amount of money, right? Mm-hmm. So there's these bids. ISO has this forward capacity market for the year 2025 in order to guarantee that the lights come on in 2025, right? Which is good, a good thing, certainly, right? No one's arguing with that, right? So they have this, but by that time, you're in a really kind of abstract area. Right? You're talking about the capacity to make electricity 5 years from now in an auction, right? So it all gets, your eyes start to roll back in your head, right? Mm-hmm. But trust me, this is, the grid stuff is very complicated. So anyway, here's what the snafu that has happened. ISO, in this forward capacity market for the years 2025 and 26, has said there will be a rule, a marketing rule, and the rule is called the minimum offer price rule, or MOPR, yet another acronym, okay, MOPR. Right? Mm-hmm. And the MOPR says basically that renewable, like wind turbines, are too cheap. The electricity is too inexpensive. And it will impact the reliability of the markets in 2025 if I let this cheap electricity on the grid. Now, you can argue with that. Right. And I think there's good reason to argue, but I mean, that's kind of the rationale of saying, oh, we're not going to let the wind turbine people bid into this market to supply electricity in 2025 because her emails, right, or something, right? They don't want it to happen. And so now all of a sudden you're saying, well, geez, we need to have all this. The state of Massachusetts has committed to gigawatts of wind, mm-hmm. right? But by 2030, and ISO, the federal group, is saying, well, no, in 2025 and 26, you can't even bid into the market. And it makes your head explode, right?
Yeah.
And what's worse is that this decision was made kind of at the last minute, big switcheroo in January, just last month, because ISO was going to abolish the rule, but they said, oh, we're going to keep it for two more years. So all of a sudden, everyone's got their hindquarters back on their hind legs saying, you know, what are you guys doing? Mm-hmm. And there's an article of Maura Healey, right, in the Globe. I think you noted it, right?
That's one of the ones that I saw. Yeah.
We can't let this happen, right? And so the issue is that, so now you rewind all the way back to FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They have already said that this MOPR, the MOPR rule, that's a bad idea. FERC said it's a bad idea. They told ISO, get rid of that MOPR rule. Mm-hmm. ISO, I mean, they have more moxie than I would ever have talking to my boss. The boss says, get rid of that rule. ISO says, I don't think so. I kind of like that rule.
I want to do it this way.
I want to do that rule. So it is now incumbent in with the pressure point for politicians and individual citizens is to send an email to FERC saying, you guys need to slap the wrist of ISO New England and tell them to kill that MOPR extension because we need the power on the grid now.
Right.
And it speaks to, I mean, I become more and more enchanted with this whole grid thing. I mean, the whole grid, the way we get our electricity is predicated on principles from the early part of the 19th century, the 1910s and 20s, mm-hmm. when a monopoly was given to these people to reliably provide electricity. And they're heavily regulated, right? DPU, all these groups regulate it, which is, you know, good, but the business model is getting outdated, right? And we need to include new stuff in the grid incentives, alignments. And so they mm-hmm. Was that in any way clear? Does that provide?
Well, let me try and replay it and see if it comes close to clear. So the ISO New England had this rule, which was due to expire. In their planning, they said, yeah, we'll do so. Yeah, we'll do so. And then all of a sudden they said, no, we won't, and extended it for 2 years. And the argument is that in order to take away the rule, we'd actually get cheaper electricity? What gives? That's a problem.
I think
Never mind the bigger point of, oh, by the way, the cheaper electricity is actually the greener electricity. That's the real issue that we want to drive home here as well.
Right. And that's the point that the head commissioner of FERC, mm-hmm. a guy named Glick, his last name is Glick. He was saying exactly what you're saying. And that this is why it's anti-competitive. It makes prices go up. It does all these bad things. But ISO right. New England nevertheless chose to preserve that. And if you're a conspiratorial, you say, well, they're just ISO New England is taking care of their buddies in the fossil fuel industry because they're all, you've heard the captured agencies, right? Where the people that are being regulated, the industries that are being regulated basically have so many friends at the regulator that, right. you know,
yeah.
Is that true?
The regulatory say. Industrial complex, yeah. so to speak. Yeah.
So it's a big deal because we need to get that renewable energy onto the grid as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And this rule, even though the whole thing is couched in a lot of jargon and a lot of bureaucratic stuff, I think the bottom line is that we need to move to renewable energy, and there needs to be an acceptance of that on the part of the grid industry. Again, without going down into too much detail, I think what's happening is there's a bunch of different reasons, but at least one of the contributing things is that the ISO New England looks at the wind turbine guys and says, oh, it costs you $1 million to build a wind turbine, but the state's going to give you $500,000, right? So if you come to me and say, well, that my price is based on that $500,000, that's a fake. Because that tax may go, that benefit may go away, and then I've got higher prices, yada 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 yada, right? And so that kind of thing is like, it because my I had the same question you had. It, like if there's a minimum offer price that you need to get into the auction, and my cost is less, then I'm just making money, right? That's not how it works. You're not allowed to go in because there's some pre-analysis that ISO does to keep you out,
right? So we're continuing on this journey. Hopefully, at least you listeners, thank you for listening. Hopefully, things have made a little bit more sense, at least in terms of some of the rising sea levels we talked about, in terms of some of the emission goals, which maybe we met, but maybe the pandemic helped us meet. And now with this other decision that certainly, if you're so inclined, you can write to FERC and we can include some contact info in the show notes. And we'll also put a plug in too that if you've got a climate issue or question that you'd like us to try and dive into, we've got this as a continuing series. So we're going to meet on a regular basis and we'll find some things along the way. And hopefully I need to make some sense of climate. Hopefully you want to as well. And thank you, Ted, for helping me along this journey.
I would just, to your point about questions, I mean, there are no questions that are too dumb. Right. People oftentimes are embarrassed to ask the question, but most of the time, the most stupid sounding question is the most insightful because it goes right to some root.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember decades ago now, I was making a presentation on climate change and I wanted to practice. So I get my million siblings and my mom and my pop and my Uncle Joe all together. Right. Sure. And I made the presentation and you know, I go on for 20 minutes. And at the end, my mother looks at me and says, well, what's a fossil fuel? Which I mean, I lost her in the first sentence, right?
Oops.
So leveling everyone up to some place we're all sort of is important. And there's no questions that shouldn't be asked.
And we have introduced terminology. We've introduced some acronyms. So we'll keep a tick list of those terms and those acronyms. So at some point, as we go through this series and we're in number three, how far are we going to go? Who knows? We're just strapping in the seatbelts and going for the ride. So thank you again for doing this. And
thank you. It's been wonderful.
Yes, indeed. And hopefully, thank you, Franklin listeners and other listeners. You may not all be based in Franklin. Climate is certainly a global issue, not just here in Franklin. So we do this at least because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.